Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Confidence starts with loving who you are. And when your skin feels nourished and glows on the outside, you naturally radiate confidence from the inside. Give your skin a glow up with Osea's clinically proven Mega Moisture Duo. This ultra-hydrating body care features two of Osea's best sellers, Undaria Algae Body Oil and Undaria Collagen Body Lotion. These seaweed-powered heroes use skincare-level ingredients normally reserved for your face for results you can see and confidence you can feel. Osea has been making clean, clinically proven seaweed-infused face and body care products for over 28 years. This luxurious skincare is vegan, cruelty-free, and climate-neutral certified, so you never have to choose between your values and your best skin. Glow from the inside out. Get 10% off your first order with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code GLOW.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. There is an incredible facility right here in downtown Toronto that is helping on the front lines and is doing incredible innovative research. They are a facility that treats everybody with dignity, and they need your help. May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. If this matters to you, help CAMH. There's no better place for your resources. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand. And donate now. Help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. This episode is brought to you by a mattress with a name, and that name is Douglas. More than 200,000 Canadians trust their Douglas mattress. They trust it so much they sleep on it. I have tried a Douglas mattress, and it's incredibly comfortable. It's a high-quality product at a very affordable price. Comes with a 365-night trial and a 20-year warranty. Douglas is giving our listeners a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. That is douglas.ca/CanadaLand. Jaron Kerr.
Jesse, what's up?
Deputy editor here at Canada Land. Good to have you on Shortcuts.
Good to be here.
Jaron, today we are going to talk about Justin Trudeau in blackface three times. How the fuck did we miss that?
God knows. I don't know.
And Canada's reporters bravely declare their independence from their own union.
Yeah, I mean, I guess they feel like they need to.
Good to have you here.
Yeah, good to be here.
This episode of Shortcuts is brought to you by Lara Casciola, Neil Excel, Micah Lowenstein, Christine Rankin, Nathan Skyers, Andrea Porter, Ben Kerwin, and Lee Elliott.
I'm Lee Elliott from Bolton, and I'm an Agile coach. Canada Land has earned my support through the creation of some incredible podcasts, such as Commons and Oppo, as well as doing the dirty work reporting on areas that other organizations are not doing, such as the Thunder Bay series and the MeToWe Foundation. Interesting perspectives and great hosts like Jen Gerson keep me informed and entertained.
Okay, Jaron, we are, you know, it feels like months into Justin Trudeau in blackface. It just broke last week. And as much as this has been hashed over and being talked about globally, the implications of the analysis of it, I'm still hung up on the genesis of the story itself.
Okay, so what's confusing you, or what are you thinking about?
My initial take remains my take, which is, how did Canadian media miss this? How did we get scooped on this? The first thing I thought is, like, look, this isn't like the early days of vetting a new candidate. How many people have had the job of vetting Justin Trudeau? And I'm talking like Liberal Party researchers, like, before we invest in this guy, let's go through his history. I'm talking about the many opponents he's had within the Liberal Party for the candidacy in Papineau, when he ran against like opponents who would very much like to have this oppo on him. Mm-hmm. When he ran against Marc Garneau and others for the Liberal Party leadership, they would have liked to have had this on him. So conservatives, liberals, and the media, if you were given the job, okay, Jaron, vet Justin Trudeau, or anyone for that matter, where do you start when you're going through somebody's past?
I mean,
you know what, you know, I'm going with this.
Of course.
Yearbooks.
Yes.
Wouldn't that be the first thing you would want?
Maybe, but I think like the thing is, Justin Trudeau has always been really famous. And I think that changes the way that people vet Justin Trudeau, because he's been in public. He's been in the public eye. And maybe that makes people think that they don't need to dig as much because he's already there. There's no real secrets. Justin Trudeau has been Justin Trudeau, who has been known, if not a household name, you know, to certain political circles or certain people in certain circles in Canada. They know who this guy is. He's the son of a former prime minister. Like, there's not much need on the face of it, I guess, for people to dig because they think they know who this guy is.
Because you'd figure if Pierre Elliott Trudeau's son showed up at a costume party in full brown face where nobody else was dressed like that, you would know about that.
Yeah.
And I think there's some people who will think that I'm pointing at like there was some sort of a cover-up or this was suppressed. I think that your explanation is the likeliest explanation, is that it was hiding in plain sight. Now, I got pushback when I asked the question of the Canadian media, how did we miss this? Because mm-hmm. people said, oh, Jesse, it's not like Time magazine beat us and scooped us by digging in a way that we didn't. This was obviously handed to Time magazine. And I think that's a reasonable thing for Canadian journalists to think based on the way that Time magazine presented their sourcing. But there is a contradiction. And I know you're aware of this. I'm going to run through this for the benefit of our listeners. The Times story itself, which was three reporters shared the byline, and the way that they explained where the story came from is as follows. They said, earlier this month, Time obtained a copy of the yearbook, The View, with the photograph of Trudeau in brownface from Vancouver businessman Michael Adamson, who was part of the West Point Grey Academy community. Adamson was not at the party, which was attended by school faculty, administrators, and parents of students. He said that he first saw the photograph in July and felt it should be made public. This suggests, it doesn't actually say he brought it to Time. It just says that we obtained it from him. But the fact that he saw it in July, and then this only got to Time now, I think a lot of people took that to mean like, okay, this guy obviously, like whether he was a conservative operative or just somebody who wanted to see Trudeau go down, the fact that there was this lag between when he saw it and when Time got it, it kind of describes this Adamson as the agent through which the story came to light.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that narrative is pretty explicitly contradicted by what one of the reporters, Anna Kambampati, told NPR Radio like the next day. And I don't think she's given an interview since then.
Mm-hmm.
But in this one interview, this reporter, when asked that same question of like, how did you get this photograph? She said,
I'd heard about it as a source of gossip in a Vancouver community and, you know, contacted a source to see the photo and was sent the yearbook.
So not only has Anna Kambampati kind of disappeared since that NPR interview, I haven't seen her in the Canadian media at all. You can see all these Canadian reporters asking her for interviews on Twitter. I don't think she's given any of them any information. She's also deleted her website and her Instagram since that story came out. Now, by that account, Time reporters heard some gossip and went digging.
Mm-hmm.
Now, both of those things could be true. They suggest different narratives, but I guess they could both be true. If Time magazine's reporter, Anna Kambampati, heard the gossip, went searching for somebody who had the yearbook, and then found Adamson, and then Adamson was like, oh yeah, I saw this yearbook last summer. I think the public should know about it. But it does contradict, I think, the suggested narrative of the Time story, which was that this was like just simply a matter of political warfare.
Yeah, I mean, I think that these are not really contradictions. I think if you read between the lines, this is an NPR interview. People write differently than they speak and vice versa. And I think, you know, she says that a source sent it to her. I mean, the source was probably just Adamson. I mean, the way I see it is Kambampati heard about this gossip, was looking for somebody who could confirm this, and hopefully she got she asked a couple people and somebody gave her the yearbook, and it was probably Adamson. I don't think there is a contradiction here, really.
I think there's a contradiction between the two narratives that these two different accounts suggest.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's some very careful wording going on here, and I think it's curious that A, no one has been able to find Michael Adamson,
mm-hmm.
and B, Kambampati has not spoken to anybody since. Nor any of the other reporters have spoken to anybody since. Now, I understand it's sensitive when you're dealing with sources.
Of course.
But this is a news story that might affect who is the Prime Minister of Canada.
Sure.
And I think that whether or not this was basically strategic
politics mm-hmm. that this came out when it did, or whether this was reporters digging, I mean, is not just a matter of importance to me as a media reporter and critic who's curious about why America beat us to this story, which I think is actually like a very good question and a relevant question. But I think it also absolutely, I don't understand Time Magazine's reluctance, even if they're simply their story is simply to say, we have sources to protect, so there's a limited amount of information that we can give you about how this came to be. However, the question is, did we ask for the photo or was the photo provided to us? That doesn't betray your source.
I think
why couldn't they tell us that?
I think you're the only person asking, though. If I think about SNC-Lavalin, that's a massive story. We don't know very much about the sourcing, and that doesn't change the story. The story still matters.
The sourcing is part of the story. I mean, we know that reporters use this kind of language all the time. Time obtained a copy of the yearbook.
But didn't Time go a bit further than most news media in the sense that they actually named their source? I mean,
Do you find it curious that nobody has been able to locate this person?
I mean, personally, I'll tell you, I've tried to look for this guy. I think I might have gotten close. I think maybe I did find him, but he just didn't return my calls. But I mean, maybe he just doesn't want to talk. Maybe it was like, I'm going to send this to Time and I don't want to deal with the publicity, right? It's a lot of stress when you're just a normal person and, you know, you have hundreds of media outlets just bombarding you, asking you for more information. And I mean, from this guy's perspective, I think it's like he did his job. Like he put his name beside this, you know, besides this thing and said, I'm the one who gave Time the yearbook. I mean, he must have given them permission to use his name. He did that, which is more than most sources do. Most sources will, you know, just like shroud themselves in anonymity, give you something, you know, in an envelope or whatever, and you just say, yeah, Candleland obtained, Time obtained. I think they went a step further. Maybe they actually did a better job than most news media.
I think we need to know more about this, and I'll tell you why. There are already conspiracy theories festering online. Mm-hmm. There's this elaborate one that people keep sending me, like, Jess, you got to look into this, and it's, you know, I think it's ridiculous on the face of it. It's got mm-hmm. Kambampati went to a Christian prep school, and she obviously as part of some conservative plot, and Adamson, the likely Adamson involved is this artist who I think is a different person than you've located it mm-hmm. to. This is the environment through which these types of things take hold. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's dangerous when people start thinking that they're like sinister forces at work.
For sure.
It's something that could easily be cleared up if Time tells us what they are able to, even if it's simply to tell us, here's what we can't.
Do you think that would quell anybody's rumblings if they are conspiracy theorists?
Do I think that information is a antidote to conspiracy theories? Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that in shrouded mystery is where conspiracy theories bloom.
To an extent. But I also think that it's not necessarily the job of a reporter to try to, they should be accountable for their work. But when people just start making stuff up. I mean, as you know very well, I was the subject of some very strange op-eds a couple months ago where people were saying all kinds of things about me.
And well, how did we counter that? By telling the truth about your work.
Absolutely, right? But at the same time, I mean, there's stuff out there that I can't get rid of that was said about me that I know is an absolute lie. All I can do is just stand by my work. It's a waste of my time and energy to address every single person who wants to act like, you know, I have some nefarious intent or that, you know, I'm comparable to a plagiarist. I can't really spend too much time on that. It's not worth the effort. I mean, I'd like to talk about the fact that maybe nobody cared. Maybe nobody cared that much, right? And I think to shift a little bit.
Talk about that. That's really interesting.
Yes. I mean,
because there were a lot of people at that party.
There was an Abacus poll that came out recently and it said about 42% of people who they polled didn't really care about this blackface thing. It didn't really bother them. There were certain shifts when you got to visible minorities, when you got to younger people where more of them cared. But the overwhelming, you know, consensus from this poll, at least, which I don't know how accurate it is that a lot of people just aren't that bothered by it. Another good chunk of them basically said, didn't love it, but I accept his apology. And I'll be clear, anecdotally, there are a lot of people that I've seen, people that I know and people that I'm just seeing that of all ages, all races, including black people my age, I'm 24, who don't really care about this thing. And I think that there's a couple things to that. One is just that a lot of people in Canada don't understand the history of blackface. They don't know what blackface is. They think that blackface is, you know, at worst in poor taste or insensitive. They don't know what the word minstrelsy means. They don't know the history of this thing. It's a 200-year-old practice of, you know, subjugating, dehumanizing, mocking people of color, especially black people. And then, you know, there's forms of doing it to native people, like, you know, playing native and things like that. This has been in Canada and the US for hundreds of years, but I think that's lost upon most people. And so I think that if you don't have that context, if you don't have that history, and to my view, most people don't, it really is just, oh, this guy painted his face. Maybe it wasn't so great, but what's the big deal?
So here, is this a Canadian media thing? And much was made of the fact that all the reporters covering Trudeau were white.
Yeah.
And that newsrooms still remain largely white.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you're extending this beyond that to Canada writ large.
Yeah.
That Canada does not have the same sophistication on this issue as perhaps America does.
I want to shout out David Aiken from Global, because he actually tweeted some of the questions that he apparently asked. He addressed the fact that, you know, Tonda McCharles of The Star posted this photo of the Liberal, I think it was the bus or the plane, and was all white reporters, and people made a big deal out of that, and that's completely understandable. But he said, you know, I've been asking people of color what I should ask Justin Trudeau about this. And one of the things he apparently asked Trudeau was, can you tell us why blackface is offensive? I don't know if there was an answer to that.
I don't think he's answered that.
I wish that there was,
yeah.
Because I don't think that media coverage has done a great job explaining why this is a problem. We can talk about some of the columns that have come out about this. And I mean, some of them have been so dismissive and so strange. I mean, there's been a lot of good ones, but there's also been things like Heather Malik had this. Can I just pull up this Heather Malik column?
Oh, please all means.
So Heather Malik writes this column this week about blackface. And apparently she was on vacation or she was gone for a little bit. She comes back to this big issue. And I mean, what she calls it is a crude Trump-style campaign distraction picked up and pumped up by the media. She thinks this is not a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Heather Malik prefaces the fact that she's of mixed race, which I guess, you know, absolves her of, you know, this. She's very dismissive. I mean, she says Trudeau is an interesting man who comes from a stylish, theatrical family with roots in BC and Quebec.
Oh my God.
He likes dressing up at Halloween. He just likes dressing up.
Yeah.
The French are like that. And it's like, oh, are you serious?
Wow.
And she later says that the U.S. slavery has, you know, had a real legacy there. Canada never had that. That's a lie. We did have a slave trade.
Sure.
It was much smaller, but it did happen. Racism is an issue that doesn't consume us here. She goes on to blame Andrew Scheer for this when Andrew Scheer did not publish this, timed it. This was not a piece of Oppo research, at least not through the Conservative Party. Clearly, it's just it's this dismissive thing. And I think this is kind of, frankly, as much as I might not love this column, it's probably reflective of what a lot of people think.
You know, it's interesting to see who is dismissive, and not just dismissive, but who is kind of like, let's just talk about the political dynamics of
yes.
this.
Yeah.
You know, Chantal Hebert, oh, you know, if he wins now, he'll be a diminished figure on the world stage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Stephen Maher McLean saying, okay, this is Jagmeet Singh's moment, Andrew Scheer's opportunity.
Ibbotson said similar things, yeah.
Yeah, they're like, what are the political implications? Meanwhile, you know, to the credit of the media, everybody did go through the Rolodex of like racial issues, and, you know, they got a bunch of writers of color to write what they thought, and none of whom, I guess, unless we count Heather Malik, was dismissive.
Yeah.
Everyone thought this was very important.
A lot of them were in American media, which is also interesting,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, they took that message to American media.
I mean, Vicky Mulchama was in National Post.
Washington Post, yeah.
Washington Post, sorry. Sarah Haji was in Vogue. But yeah, I mean, these columns were obviously more personal, right? They weren't emotional, I would say, but
yeah.
These are people who can relate to racism and relate to being mocked racially. Where the other ones, yeah, even though, you know, people kind of addressed the racial issues, it was really just like, what are the implications? How does this affect the horse race? It's not something that would be top of mind if you're a person of color and you've dealt with this, right?
It was such an example of why it matters to have diversity. I mean, like, even when you're getting people who are critical, not dismissing it, Leah McLaren was very critical mm-hmm. of Trudeau in her Guardian piece on this, but it was just so riddled with, I mean, you know, she was building this case of how Trudeau loves to apologize for things that aren't really his fault, you know, but when something is his fault, it's a different story. And she's sort of like, he apologized for this, he apologizes for that. And then she writes, and here's a further apology, which is kind of connected to a Trudeau apology. Every morning across Canada, school children recite an apology to the Indigenous people on whose stolen land they are lucky to be standing. That's not true.
That's a land acknowledgement, right? When that happens in some school boards, I think.
Well, she, I think, is referring to the acknowledgement and calling it an apology.
Mm-hmm.
The acknowledgement is like very explicitly, if language means anything, you're acknowledging that we're standing on Indigenous land. You're certainly not apologizing for it.
Yeah.
Furthermore, it's not recited by kids. It's like, you know, in some schools, read over the loudspeakers.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, that has nothing to do with Trudeau.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that was just a complete, it was a series of factual inaccuracies that ran in The Guardian. And I think it just has to do with when people don't have a personal connection to the stuff, and it's only sort of as a rhetorical device.
I also think that, you know, for a number of reasons, when you write in an international publication, there's a lot of things that Canadians can say about Canada that a lot of people would, you know, blink twice at. But if you're writing it for a different audience, they don't know any better, right? We talk about this all the time. The New York Times will have like this very strange portrait of like what Canada is. And, you know, this is this revered newspaper, but when they're writing about it, it doesn't reflect what we see, right? Because you know, these are people who are parachuting in, right? And they see one instance, they see a snapshot, and it's like, this is what Canada is. And it's very strange to Canadians. And I think when you're any columnist or any writer who's writing for international publications, you have more power to kind of reflect on what you think about the country more than what the consensus or the popular thought is, because your editor doesn't know any better either. I think there are probably some editors who might think the same as a lot of these Canadians, like, this is kind of notable, but it's not a big deal. Let's move on. And, you know, I think what we're hearing from a lot of voters, just to talk about voters again for a second, is that this is a harm reduction thing, right? Some people are saying it in a more crude way, in the sense that, well, why would I vote for Andrew Scheer? You know, there's all those racists in his party. You might as well pick Trudeau. He has a better record, even though he did this when he was a kid. He wasn't a kid. He was 30 years old. You know, people vote defensively, right? And there are voting patterns in Canada that, you know, are kind of similar to the U.S., where, especially for Black voters, I can speak to that a little bit. Some Black voters are always going to vote Liberal because Justin's father brought them here, like my parents. My parents are here because of Pierre Trudeau's policies. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what my parents are going to vote. I actually haven't talked to them about the blackface thing very much, but I do know that that's what people think about. They think about the legacy. They think about, well, you know, is it worth it to vote conservative just because of this one thing? They think about overall, which policies are going to be better for me and what makes more sense? And I think a lot of people are just going to assume, lots of people of color are just going to assume, well, there are lots of white people who are doing racist stuff. And if I just try to eliminate all of them, I won't have that many to pick from in public, in public life. You know, people are going to say these are small potatoes when you think about, you know, taxes and childcare and health and everything else. And I would not blame any person of any race for prioritizing that.
So, Jaron, between the two ways the columnists went, actually dealing with blackface, its history, its implications, mm-hmm. or just, you know, handicapping what impact it's going to have on the horse race, which of those conversations do you think is most important?
Honestly, it's the horse race. I'm not going to pretend like it's the emotional thing.
Who gives a shit about the horse race?
Everybody.
You're the one who's saying that Canada doesn't even begin to understand the history of this
issue.
Which
is why these columns fall on deaf ears, right? If you actually are a Canadian consumer who chooses to read that, you might say, oh, there are some good points there. But guess what? I need to think about the next 4 years. I need to think about my family. I need to think about taxes. I need to think about my children and whatever, right? It's a pragmatic way of looking at this. And I mean, for me, you know, as a journalist of color, I look at these things and I say, I'm going to read all these columns from people of color, and that might be therapeutic or I might be able to relate to it. But at the end of the day, I am far more interested in what white people think. Because white people make up the majority of the country, and white people are, you know, more of a voice for what, you know, the voters are going to do. People of color are going to be upset, but it's kind of like, so what? And not in the sense that I don't care, but in the sense that we just have to acknowledge that a lot of people don't. And so we have to think about them when we think about this election.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp, therapy online that has served over 3 million people around the world, and it's available here in Canada. And this time of year, we're all emerging from our winter, like, seclusion and, you know, patio season and socializing, and it can be terrifically fun, but it can also create a lot of pressure. And some people get, like, anxiety, social anxiety from being out too much. What did Iggy Pop say about social life? It's torture dressed as fun. It doesn't need to be torture. I think it's just about finding, like, the right balance of how much of other people do you want? I mean, we need each other, but I think that at a certain point, it can become overwhelming. And talking to somebody about yourself, about your social life, about your relationships, is a way of gaining insight into what is right for you. It's not selfish to examine that with a professional. And as the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Listeners of the show get 10% off of their first month at betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. That's better, H-E-L-P, betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. This episode is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. Trust is important. There are a lot of mattress lies out there, a lot of mattress liars. And I didn't intend the pun, but it occurred to me that there is one as I was saying those words. Listen, I am not lying to you. I have experienced the Douglas mattress. It is an exceptional mattress at a surprisingly affordable price point. It is a mattress that sleeps cool, doesn't have that weird thing in the summer where the mattress gets like an oven. It's a very good product. It's delivered to your house in a box. You don't have to go to a big mattress store. It is a medium firm mattress, which is what Canadians prefer, and it comes with a 365-night trial and a 20-year warranty. What more can I tell you? Douglas is giving our listeners a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. Jaron, it's time for Duly Noted. I want to know what you have to duly note that needs to be duly noted.
Since we were talking about America before, I want to talk about America a little bit more. This is an interesting development in California. So basically, there was this bill that was signed into law in California that caps freelance articles at 35 a year. So if you are, and I'll read it out, if you are a freelance writer, editor, photographer, editorial cartoonist, you can publish up to 35 what they call content submissions in the given year in the state of California. The whole purpose of this was basically, it was based on this law in California that was supposed to stop, employers, mainly big tech companies and things like that, from just subcontracting a bunch of, you know, freelancers or outsourcing a bunch of work. It was supposed to be a progressive pro-labor policy that was supposed to help, workers have more secure employment, right?
Okay.
And so sort of every policy has some unintended consequences. And so they tried to carve out special exceptions for, people who do work in creative economies who maybe either by choice or by force freelance. And so they came up with this number, 35 content submissions per year. And that's how many that you can, do, I guess, in the state of California. And anything more is, I guess, against this law.
If you're a freelance journalist, you're capped at 35 submissions
a year.
What happens at 36?
I'm not exactly sure.
Put you on staff or something?
No. I mean, they can't force you to employ them. But the whole point is that this is supposed to push companies to hire people instead of just having them as freelancers or subcontractors or whatever.
But really, it just limits how much work you can do.
Yeah, and that's the problem, right? So a lot of journalists in California and just other content creators have come out and basically said, well, now I can't make any money because I might do 35 content submissions in a month.
Yeah.
Right? Depending on the kind of work you do. I mean, there are complete exemptions for graphic designers, right? They don't have to face this. So if you're a photographer, also does graphic design, then it's kind of fuzzy. You got to go back and forth and see what counts as what. But I mean, what this really shows is that a lot of policies have these adverse effects. And now a lot of journalists in California who might, spend a lot of their time writing for local publications and maybe prefer to freelance, they can't anymore. Like, they can't in the same way. And that poses a major problem for, shrinking newsrooms, and more journalists are doing their own thing. It just gets harder and harder for people to make money, even when California's trying to do the opposite.
That's really fucking weird.
Yeah.
Duly noted.
Yeah.
I just want to duly note further, this election's the worst. Like, what, Elizabeth May has a reusable cup and metal straw photoshopped into her hand.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're covering. I mean, yeah, you're going to cover that, sure. And then she's like, I don't want to call my staffers stupid, but but they're stupid. And then you got Bob Ray on Twitter. Bob Ray objecting to a CBC poll, right? It's a poll where CBC is showing that, the Liberals have taken a hit and a poll of overall voters, conservatives are benefiting after this scandal.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't like this because that is a classic election night mistake. Nothing breaks clearly until the last week. It's a horse race for sure. Typical complaints that people make about polls.
Sure.
It's not just about the overall electorate. And then he finishes his tweet by saying, of the CBC poll, and who wins will be very consequential for CBC. What? Nice little public broadcaster you got there. Be a shame if something happens to it. What the hell is Bob Ray, the former interim leader of the Liberal Party, Party elite?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, he's post-politics now. Yeah, right.
Yeah, sure.
What the hell is he doing complaining about a CBC poll and threatening about dire consequences for the CBC? What is the implication? Like, don't publish polls I don't like, CBC? Because if the conservatives win, that's it for you? Which he basically confirmed in a subsequent email, which also he was like, Andrew Scheer said he's gonna kill the CBC newsroom if he wins. So yes, I am saying that CBC should be pretty damn careful about which side it favors in its coverage, which is like fucked up in like two different ways, because Andrew Scheer's walked that back since. That's actually not Scheer's position on CBC anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Ray is twisting it, but like he's sort of standing by this threat.
Mm-hmm.
What the fuck is going on in this democracy? I don't know, where, what do you cover in this? None of this is actual issues. It's just this ephemera.
Yeah.
And it's dumb.
Yeah.
The voter is being treated like a fucking idiot.
I mean, I think that people have to find their spots in this election and cover weird things. And so the May stuff, I mean, it's kind of funny. She's the Green Party leader that they did this. I mean, it's a gaffe. It's something to laugh at.
We would have run it too. I'm just despairing.
Like, yeah. I mean, as for the Ray stuff, I think it kind of proves the point I was making earlier. Like, this is all about the end goal for people and what this means in terms of outcomes. This is not about morality. And a lot of people argue that politics should not be about morality. This is about, you know, I don't know if he's saying this to the CBC or to, you know, readers or people who care about the CBC, but like, hey, if you want the CBC to stay around, watch out for those conservatives. They don't like you very much. I mean, it's not about, why would we think about some blackface stuff from 20 years ago when the CBC is at stake? This is just one example of like people's priorities are in the future.
Emotional buttons, but I'm not even talking about morality. I'm like, you know, like the fucking oceans and lakes are coming for our cities. Mm-hmm. The robots are coming for our jobs. There's real shit to talk about.
Yeah, but know? I mean, people like to talk about, you know, the ephemeral weird stuff, right? It is what it is. Duly noted.
I have one last one.
Okay, let's hear it.
We're recording on Wednesday. People are hearing this on Thursday. Mm-hmm. It's your last day here at Canadaland.
It's my last day here.
Yeah. Jaron Kreet, you started here in our apprenticeship program.
Yeah.
And went off to the Star, came back to us as a reporter.
Yep.
Promoted to deputy editor.
Yep.
And now you're leaving.
I'm heading out. I'm going to go try something new. Can't say too much about what it is now, but what I can say is I'm still going to be a journalist, still going to be in Toronto, hopefully still going to be doing things that people care about and are interested in. But every once in a while, an opportunity comes that you can't really pass up. That's how I felt when I came back to Canada Land in 2018 after being at the Star. So, you know, it was just really, I saw an opportunity to do something different, unique, and I grabbed at it. And, you know, soon enough, people will figure out what that is. But I'm leaving this place extremely happy that I ended up here. I don't know how many people know, but if you'll indulge me for a sec, I was a fan of Candleland from really young, 5-6 years ago. And I bugged Jesse every once in a while to hire me. Eventually he did, took a chance on me. And I think that's the reason why I even get this opportunity that you guys will learn about later. So I'm very grateful to have been at this place, you know, taking a lot of really good memories with me. But this is my last day.
That's very kind. The nice things you say. I think we did very well out of this arrangement in that the work you did here, I put a lot on you in asking you to investigate, you know, an organization that nobody had really investigated before, and one that came at us with five different lawyers from five different firms that made all sorts of threats, accusations. You are a young reporter, and the stress that put you under was remarkable, put a lot on your shoulders, and you carried it. And the stories that came out, solid. And a lot of people ask me, like, so how's the lawsuit going? We haven't been sued. Mm-hmm. These stories hold up because they're accurate. I can't thank you enough for what you've done here. But that's just one part of it. The second part is, with regards to this new opportunity, I totally get it. People come, people go. To start something new on the ground floor is something that, you know, you get few chances in life to do so. So, you know, I don't know much about this, but I wish you luck with that. I'm very interested in it. But you're still deputy editor here.
I am.
And your job is to help me understand what's going on in the Canadian media.
Okay.
So your secrecy, the fact that I don't know what this new media company is.
Yeah.
You're actually in conflict of interest.
Yeah, I mean,
you have to tell me.
That's a very weak argument, Jesse. I you know, good for you for trying. You will know the same time everybody. Actually, I've told
you've
done
your
stuff.
Job so diligently. This whole, why screw it up on your last day and deprive? You don't work for them. You still work for me.
I mean, the question should be, how did you miss this? Right? Why didn't you get it? You should have got it.
Good luck, Jaron.
Yeah, thank you so much, Jesse.
I guess you got to say duly noted.
Yeah, duly noted.
Jaron, as you know, this election has just exploded. The news of it has gone worldwide. It is a lot to get one's head around. Luckily, Canadians have a bridge to understanding this federal election, and that is The Bridge, Peter Mansbridge's daily podcast. Mansbridge is doing this out of the kindness of his own heart, a 20-minute podcast every day. Mm-hmm. However, Canadians might not all be listening to every episode of Peter Mansbridge's The Bridge, but we are checking it out, and we are highlighting the most exciting, the most relevant, the best parts. So here it is, The Bridge to the Bridge. Tiffany, take me to the bridge.
Well, I think I'll take him to the bridge.
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 All right, if I take him, yo. Yeah. Take him to the bridge. Yeah. Yeah, one time. Bam!
Bam!
some new music there. The bridge finds new music. And there we have it. Okay, letters. Has issues. I'm sorry my phone's ringing in the background, but it underlines to you once again that I'm doing this from from my home. This is not one of those podcasts. This is backed by a big media organization. It's just little old me in my little old studio in my little old apartment. And loving every minute of it.
So, Jaron, as you know, when the media bailout appointed their special panel, it was a highly politicized panel that included Unifor. Unifor has a seat on this panel, and Unifor, of course, has taken a political position. And just to kind of go back in time a little bit, this is what Conservative MP Candace Bergen said about that in Parliament.
Mr. Speaker, the Liberals' media funding plan needs to be sent back to the drawing board. By putting overtly anti-conservative Unifor on the panel, the Prime Minister is not only threatening the media's independence, but he's threatening the credibility of the panel. And now even the Canadian Association of Journalists has spoken out about the lack of transparency of the bailout. Will the Prime Minister start respecting journalists and fix this mess that he's created?
So that's what the Conservatives have to say about Unifor being on the panel. It seems that a lot of Globe and Mail reporters share this concern about Unifor's involvement compromising journalistic independence because, like, what was it, like 30 of them?
Something like that.
They're all signatories. You know, a lot of senior people and, like, you know, Robin Doolittle and all kinds of names that we will know from the Globe and Mail saying to Unifor, to Jerry Diaz, you do not speak for us when it comes to politics.
Yeah, I mean, this has been a thing for a while. A lot of journalists inside and outside of Unifor, non-unionized and unionized alike, have been concerned about people like Jerry Diaz being so blatantly partisan. And the fact that he is anti-conservative only sort of builds into this, you know, theory by some of the public that, you know, journalists are in the bag for the Liberal Party. And, you know, the bailout is just an extension of that. And so now there are all these special interests and external groups that, you know, media companies and journalists are connected to that are partisan, right? They're connected to the Liberals because of this bailout, whether they want to be or not. And they're connected to Unifor, some of them, because of, you know, Jerry Diaz opining about what's wrong with Andrew Scheer. And so it creates an issue where a lot of journalists have to constantly be saying, I'm independent, I'm independent. And some of them might prove that in their stories and in their coverage. But at the end of the day, the optics are really, really bad.
So I think that you summarize this very well. Journalism has become politicized in two different ways. One of which is that the union that represents us is actively campaigning against Andrew Scheer and saying, meet the resistance. Unionized employees are like, unionized employees from Unifor are the resistance to Andrew Scheer. Who is counted amongst the unionized employees of Unifor? Journalists, I guess, were the resistance against Andrew Scheer. Mm-hmm. Journalists, I think, quite logically stand up and say, hey, you don't speak for me. Shut the fuck up. You're compromising my independence when you campaign so openly.
Yeah.
But by that, the same brush exactly, the bailout, the fact that you've got the publisher of the Globe and Mail openly lobbying the Trudeau government for money also puts us on one side of a political fight. I did not read an open letter from the Globe and Mail reporters decrying that. What do you make of that?
I think it's a different story, right? I mean, in the sense that reporters have to be very careful about what they give their opinion about, especially depending on the newsrooms that they work in. I think where reporters are pretty much objectively allowed to voice their opinion is when they're talking about the values of truth and journalism and, you know, their place in the democracy and the importance of media. There's tons and tons of space for journalists to express, you know, support for that. But when it comes to any sort of government policy, even if it's one that directly affects the industry, I can understand why people are a bit more meek when it comes to really calling out this bailout. Yes, it does compromise, you know, the optics of independence for sure. But I would not blame a lot of journalists who feel like this is wading into politics and this makes you partisan in some way.
Well, hold on a second. I can understand them. Well, I suppose not for the same reason. If they were to decry a government policy, then that makes them a partisan actor.
Sure.
But the first thing you said, it's very easy for journalists to assert their independence.
Yeah.
Well, why wouldn't they assert it against their own publisher? Why wouldn't they say, hey, Philip Crawley, when you sign on with this Newspapers Canada, News Media Canada, when you or over at the Toronto Star, the National Post, when Godfrey writes editorials or John Hondrick writes editorials slamming the government and openly petitioning for cash, why wouldn't reporters say to them, hey, shut up. When mm-hmm. when you do that, you're compromising my independence. I mean, the answer is self-evident because that would involve criticizing management.
For
but
sure.
It didn't stop some people. I've seen Andrew Coyne decry
very powerful columnist. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe he has that privilege, and mm-hmm. Chris Selly and others. Mm-hmm. But you'll forgive me for being a little bit askance when the Globe and Mail takes this very high and mighty position against Jerry Diaz. And I think that at the Globe and Mail, it's absolutely okay to take an anti-labor position.
Sure.
And I think they're very uncomfortable with being unionized to begin with. No one's going to say to you like, "Hey, don't go up against the union. That's your union." But Will they take a stand against Philip Crawley, against the Thompsons, or against the publisher? Absolutely not. I think it's just cowardice.
There's all kinds of conflicts. I mean, every newsroom has some things that, whether they'll admit it or not, are just things that they don't touch. And I think uniformly, reporting on something that affects your own media company or your own employer is something that is extremely awkward for a lot of reporters. And it doesn't mean that reporters don't want to do it. I mean, I've gotten in trouble for this a little bit. People know the history. But a lot of editors, a lot of senior editors, whether they sanction it or not, they know that their bosses don't want their reporters writing about the media. They don't want them poking holes in what might be wrong or conflicts. It looks bad, right?
I think you got to expand on that earlier insinuation there. What were you talking about?
Okay. So, I mean, when I was a reporter at the Toronto Star, I sent out a couple tweets about this. I called it the drop and swap, which might be a bit pejorative. I think people might not like it, but it was basically this deal a couple of years ago where Post Media and Torstar basically swapped a bunch of papers, and then they destroyed a bunch of papers and just put them out of business. And the whole
it's being investigated by the Competition Bureau, where they traded and then they killed off, basically destroyed competition in tons of markets.
Exactly. They tried to, it seems like they tried to basically get a monopoly on certain areas, and they kind of did this weird anti-competitive thing. And, I tweeted about that. And I won't go into too many details. I'll respect people there. But there were certain people who did not like that I tweeted about that.
Yeah.
And it was the sort of thing that for me, especially with my ambitions to be a media reporter, which is why I came to Candleland in the first place, it was the sort of thing that, well, this is a story. This is news. It's certainly interesting. There's certainly high public interest in a bunch of local newspapers going down the toilet. And these are big, massive companies that have an impact on lots of Canadians. Of course, this is something I'm going to mention. And the reaction was more just like, hey, this is our business and we don't write about our business, right?
We don't write about our business.
And I think that for me, that was contradictory to what I thought, should be the response, which is that we don't have to be emotional about it. We don't have to write a 2,000-word story about it. But I mean, the same way that Torstar and Post Media put out, some article written often without a byline about, their quarterly earnings in the best possible light. We're losing lots of money, but we got like 5% revenue somewhere and it looks really good for them. It's the same thing. You'll write about your own company when it makes sense or when it's positive. The Star and the Globe are always going to write stories about, we won a bunch of awards, mm-hmm. right? But when it comes to, this government policy that might affect them, people are just very nervous and very meek to write about it. And it's this strange dynamic that I don't really understand, but I know enough to know that this is how a lot of people feel for whatever reason.
Well, you know what? Aside from me raising an eyebrow or calling out those Globe and Mail reporters, like, hell yeah, if you want to find your voice and you want to speak out against the politicization of journalism in Canada because you fear for your credibility, let's go from there, because mm-hmm. that is a big fucking problem right now. Like, because people do not trust us anymore to be neutral political actors. I mean, I'm not a big adherent of the objectivity school of journalism, but I definitely think that as soon as you actually become partisan actors, something is lost in the public trust. Jaron, are you seeing it play out in the public, in the conversation, people's changing perceptions, like people thinking that we're in the tank? Is that like, it's one thing to make this like a academic thing of like, oh, this will influence people's perception. Is it affecting our ability to do our jobs?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are some people who already don't like mainstream media, who are, talking about Justin's journos in the media party. And a lot of these are, fans of The Rebel and Ezra Levant. He's on Twitter calling, National Post reporters uniform men, even though the National Post is not unionized at all. And it gets tons and tons of retweets because guess what? Why would these very average, people with lives, news consumers, know that the National Post is part of Unifor or not? So it doesn't even have to be true. It doesn't have to be real. All that matters is what people think.
Well, right? You know, this makes it true enough. And some people will say, like, who cares what Ezra Levant thinks? He's going to say whatever the facts are. Mm-hmm. But I think that the facts are that when people mount that, you know, the same people who will always be against mainstream journalists and say, mm-hmm. oh, you're in the tank for this party or that, they now actually have some truth on their side. And like you say, it kind of taints everybody whether you're on the dole or not. Mm-hmm. It'll just be assumed that everybody's getting this money.
Yeah, and let's not be ahistorical here. This isn't new. Because it doesn't mean, like, you don't need Unifor and you don't need the bailout for there to be these associations that people just can't shake when they work for a certain place. When you work at the Toronto Star, like I did, there were a couple occasions where somebody who I would assume is more conservative didn't really want to talk to me because I worked for the Toronto Star, because it was assumed that we were in the tank for the Liberals. And I know that there are people who are at the National Post who worked as reporters who, you know, more liberal people didn't want to talk to people because they worked at the National Post. People already have these assumptions. And so you try not to, you know, obsess over what people are saying, but you really try, at least implicitly in your work, to really just be an arbiter of truth and fact, to hopefully combat, you know, these perceptions through your work. But the fact is, people aren't reading everything. They're not reading all of your work. They might not know who you are. They might not have read any of your work when they attack you on Twitter. They just see, you know, reporter at Toronto Star, reporter at Globe and Mail, reporter at National Post, and that means that you are aligned with something politically, whether you are or not. And that sucks.
It's our job to protect the perception mm-hmm. of who we are and what we're doing.
Yeah.
We've lost that completely.
It's gone, I think, unfortunately.
That is your Canada Land shortcuts. You can email me about it at jesse@canadalandshow.com. I read everything you send. We're on Twitter at Canada Land. Jaron Kerr, where can people find you? There's a lot of people out there who are going to want to know what comes next for you, and they're going to want to follow your work. Tell them how they can do that.
Yeah, so for now, just follow me on Twitter. I think it's the best way to keep track of what I'm doing next. It's Journo Jaron, JOURNOJAREN on Twitter.
Can't wait to find out what's next for you, Jaron. Our website is CanadaLandShow.com. Oppo is weekly this election season, and it is invaluable as a resource for you, the citizen of Canada. And a new episode of the new season of Commons, all about the families that control Canada dynasties, will be dropping on Tuesday. Check that out on our website. This episode is produced by Tiffany Lamb. Our managing editor is Kevin Sexton. Syndication is by CFUV, 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. If you like what we do, our investigations, our podcasts, all of the stuff that we make and give away for free, we do those things because we get support from people at patreon.com/CanadaLand. Please help us out. This episode is brought to you by Douglas. If you know of a better Canadian mattress at a better price point, well, you're just a liar and you're lying to me right now. No, Douglas is trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. I know this mattress. I trust this mattress. Douglas is giving our listeners a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. That's douglas.ca/CanadaLand.